Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all around this great, great world, welcome back to Deliver It, episode number 64 of your Agile Product Owners Podcast. I say it loud and proud, product owner, or if you're a product manager on an Agile project, welcome to you as well. Today, I'm very excited. One of my favorite people in the world is going to be joining us today to talk about a topic that is near and dear to his heart. Well, let's just go ahead and dispense with the formality. Bob Galen, how are you?
I'm good, Corey. How are you? Thanks for inviting me.
I think it's a requirement that I have you on at least once a season on the show.
It's a joy of mine. I mean, I have fun with you. You know that. And we poke at each other. We poke fun and we have some fun around Agile and stuff. So it's a pleasure to be here. Now, you invited product managers too. Are you? That sounded all inclusive. Are you sure you wanted to do that?
I'm okay with that. Yes,
okay.
My title right now is a product manager.
Oh, that's why. Oh, you're flip flop. Oh, okay. You flip flop are you? But if you were a product owner, you wouldn't invite them.
That's just what my company calls me right now. So you get called a ton of different names. So I don't really care. As long as I'm doing the role.
Exactly. As long as there's no like swear words in it, you're in good shape. Right?
Well, I swear occasionally. Yeah. So there's that.
But in your title.
In the title. Right.
Exactly.
So Bob is going to talk to us about what he's doing with his product owner book in a little bit. But one of the things that got a lot of attention since the last show, Modern Agile, the show that I recommended a couple times before, we've had Tim Ottinger on from Industrial Logic, which is Josh's company, which is really good. And the Modern Agile show, I really like the benefit. I got a sticker on my laptop, so I'm a fan of the show. Show is back, and on this latest episode, episode number 13, Joshua had Melissa Perry, I think Matt on, to talk about their issues with the product owner role. And I watched that. It took me a while to get there. It's kind of like Melissa's blog post of, are you a product owner or a product manager? It took me a while to get there in the right headspace to really listen and kind of hear what they're saying. And so I watched it, and I took some notes. And there's a really big discussion thread going on on LinkedIn that we'll put a show note link to. And some of the things that they state there, I agree with. I think the main problem seems to be that they have a problem seeing product owners who are basically certified or institutional kind of product owners of, that's not what Scrum says do. I have to manage the backlog. I have to admin for the team. I have to do all these things that are not about building good products and working with teams to have happy customers. And that seems to be their big beef with it. As far as I could tell, is that what you kind of get out of that, Bob?
I think, I mean, it's certification and they're slamming sort of the role, right? The CSPO. I mean, I think when they were saying CSPOs, their noses were wrinkling, right? And their foreheads were wrinkling.
Yeah.
Like, something was odoriferous in the room. So it was, it was that. They also said it was their experience. So in the back channel stuff, and Josh was doing this as well. It's like he was being very, very pervasive. It's like, you know, in my 20 years experience, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but in my 20 years experience, I've never seen a PO that actually got it right or got the balance right or something like that. And he gets around a lot. And I think Melissa and Matt were doing the same thing. It was like, you know, it wasn't just disagreeing with it. It was everyone like that is dysfunctional. Right.
Yeah. And the training that Melissa was talking about that she does with her product management institute is, you know, when she's training product managers that are product owners now, that they don't know, in her experience, they don't seem to know what they're doing most of the time, the majority of time. I think the number was around 80% or 90% that they were throwing around, that they were just doing, that she was seeing and Josh was seeing bad product owners. And I'm
correct.
More than willing to admit that there are some really bad product owners out there, right? We've seen them. We know what they, you know, they do and how they work. But that seemed to be a very broad brush. That they were painting with there, which, you know, is not my experience, but it's theirs.
You know, I don't know if it's theirs. I mean, I think people sometimes, I'm not calling them liars. I'm calling them exaggerators. Sometimes people paint this. I do it sometimes. Mm-hmm. My heart's in the right place, and I'm trying to make a point. And so I reference my client base, or I reference my experience, and I get a little rambunctious, mm-hmm. and it sounds like it's everybody. And if they're really saying everyone, then I think they are sort of lying. I mean, I get an exposure to a fair number of product owners, and they don't all suck.
Yeah.
I get a fair exposure to CSPOs. I certify some folks like that, not in my coaching, not in my training, it's not a trainer certification, but
right.
So I grant the certifications. I think there's a lot of really balanced folks out there. I think it's an incredibly hard job.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing is like, now you're starting to degrade them. And I think it is part product management and part product ownership, right? It's a very mm-hmm. broad role. And I just was disappointed in the tenor.
Yeah.
The breadth and the depth and the tenor by people who are incredibly, and this is actually what pisses me off.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is these are influential people. Like the more influential you are, I'm a little influential, but like Josh is incredibly influential. Melissa is incredibly influential. Matt sort of is maybe in my, you know, like me, mm-hmm. but we're influential, and the people hang on those words. Yeah. I mean, so the words we use matter.
Yes.
And how we couch things really matters.
Yeah.
And it just disappoints me a little bit.
Yeah. Something else that seemed to be a running thread of that conversation and also in some other things I've seen related to that is that it shouldn't be the product owner. It should be a product manager who is part of the team. That's kind of the thrust is there needs to be, unless you're working in an organization where everybody has the same customer focused, right? And that's what we're trying to get to with Lean and a lot of agile practices is get to the point where the team is invested in making the customer success, right? And the whole company is driven toward that. If you don't have that, which has been my experience, where it's been, you know, it's been the focus of a product manager or a product owner to help get there. Whether it's a product owner or a product manager who works with a team, I think you're doing the same type of things. You're doing the same type of behaviors. And what your title is, that's why I like the product nerd title that I've bestowed upon myself. It didn't really matter to me.
Well, you saw that in the four quadrants, I talk about product management being one of the quadrants, and I'm not diminishing one over the other.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I really think that there's aspects, there's cross pollination aspects to it. Right. Again, my key issue is how gross they were in making it sound like there's this dysfunction around the world. Mm-hmm. For 10, I mean, I think Josh was saying something like 9 years, 10 years, you know, It's been a pet peeve of mine for a long period of time,
yeah.
and I've never seen it work, or something. I don't think I'm exaggerating too much.
No,
like there were these broad brushes, for God's sakes, and I don't see it that way at all.
Yeah, and they were asking the question, you know, should the role be retired or should it die? To me, that's along the same aspect. I linked last episode. You know, Dave Thomas said, you know, Agile is dead. Long live Agile. Long live Agility. Right. So it's the notion that people are picking on words or specific things and saying this thing has been bastardized or talked about in the wrong way. And because it's been to the point where we don't think it should be used that way anymore, we want to change the word and change the meaning and change it to something else so that we don't keep talking about that. And I guess I don't want to see the product owner role go away. I do want to see it evolve. I do want to see it get better. I do want to see people get better. But having it retire or die, I don't know if I'm ready for that personally yet.
I even tie it beyond Scrum, and I probably get in trouble. That's why I'm not a Scrum trainer, because then I would be, you know, I would be chastised for saying this. But you know, when I talk about XP, I talk about the customer or the product owner in XP, someone's driving the list of things to do, the
right.
work, right? Someone's being a, you know, the voice of the customer. So I'll use that terminology as yeah. well, or the customer role. So XP had the customer role, and then I'll translate that in my language sometimes in classes to voice of the customer or product owner. I certainly use product owner in Kanban, mm-hmm. like someone who is feeding ready queues. I mean, there has to be someone. And I even talk about there's a backlog off the Kanban board, right? And someone is care and feeding that. And I'll typically use the term product owner for that. So I'm even agnostic. I know Scrum is the origination of it, the term. And I know there's some rules around that, but still it's like, you know, it's sort of the voice of the customer, the voice of value. I'm agreeing with you. I hope all of that stuff doesn't go away.
Yeah. And I do agree that there are people that just focus on the admin side of product ownership and that's all they want to do. And that's the wrong thing to focus on, right? It's we're trying to build better, you know, solve customer problems, and we have a list of customer problems, and that's our backlog, and we work from that. And maybe we do something that's at the top, and maybe we do something that's in the middle. It depends on the conversation with the team and the customer.
But everyone does that. I mean, coaches do that. Coaches focus on the tactics. I'm sure Melissa Perry focuses on product management, some tactics sometimes, and not getting to the core of the role, right? And getting in balance. I'm sure Josh does the same thing. We do it. Managers. Yeah. We pick on pointy-headed managers and we talk about the tactical side of the role, but there's managers out there that are actually good leaders as well.
Yeah.
So I think my disappointment was, and I want to actually make this point on the podcast. I think we have a responsibility as we grow as influencers in Agile. We have a responsibility to be more measured. We have a responsibility to be more thoughtful. Mm. We can't just cop these radical. And I know it's sexy and maybe it drives up clicks or something like that. I think we have to be sort of accountable because there are so many people that we're influencing and they don't have our experience and they don't have our nuance.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were careful. I don't think they were thoughtful, and I don't think they were careful. I think now maybe they were having a few drinks, maybe they were having some fun, maybe there was something else going on, right?
Yeah.
They were very flip in their body language. Did you see the body?
Yes.
They were like rolling of the eyes, and they were very flippant about the thing. So I don't know.
But
enough of that.
It's something that's out there. It's something I think product owners need to know about or listen to. And it's one of the things where I like to try to hear both sides on some of these arguments or multiple sides of this.
I agree with you. I mean, I think people, you know, whoever's listening in should go and follow, look at LinkedIn, view the video, but look at the LinkedIn trail. And it's by the time you get to it, it's probably going to be twice the size as it was today.
Yeah. So watch it, make up your own mind, look at the conversation. There's things I agree with. There's things I don't agree with. You can, that's the great thing. You can make up your own mind about that. So, but that's out there. So we'll put a link to that.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
Okay. So Bob is working very diligently, right, Bob?
Yes, I am.
On the third version of the product owner book that I keep right by my book stand because it's the best reference for product owners. It's the number.
I thought you were going to say like by your nightstand. So when you wake up screaming in the middle of the night, you open up the product owner book.
Let's go. Right.
And it calms you down immediately. It puts you back to sleep immediately.
It is something that I have as a ready reference. Is something I always recommend. Like I said, it's the thing that if people want to know more, that's where you need to know more. That's what you need to learn from. And Bob's done two versions of it. You're working on the third version. And I want to take a line out of here just because I think it's relevant to what you're doing, which is what you're trying to do is maintain the usefulness as a guide for the beginning product owner, but also to be a relevant resource for experienced product owners who are struggling with real world problems. And I think that's really what you're trying to update it for the last, 5 years, I think was when version 2 came out, 2012.
So the first edition was in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can actually, if you hold on a second, I'll check. Uh-oh. I think the second edition.
He's got it right there.
Is 2013.
2013. Okay.
So what was that? 9, 11, 12, 13, like 4 years different.
Yeah. Every 4 years.
And then like every 4 years or roughly, I have enough energy and enough interest to like change things. So, so it's 2017. It'll come out early in 2018 will be the third edition. So the original edition was when I first wrote it. So back it sounds like a dinosaur, but back in 2009 and really the genesis, Corey, was 2007 or so. And I was working at Channel Advisor, if I recall. And what I noticed then was there was, I was an Agile coach there. I was the VP of development or whatever. And I was also the Agile champion at Channel Advisor. And we had a whole cadre of product owners. We had a chief product owner. So we had a hierarchy of product management, product owners that were dealing with Scrum teams. But what I noticed back then was there was very little, that was the beginning of the CSPO. I'm not even sure if it existed right at the beginning of that time. There was the Scrum Guide at the time had like a half a page or a page on product ownership. And there was really nothing, and I'm not exaggerating, there was like nothing else out there. There was Scrum Master materials, there was Scrum Team stuff, there was XP stuff, but there was really nothing around the role of the product owner. And it just shocked me. And so I was inspired. And I mean, not, I mean, I had product ownership experience, but it's not like all I do. But I what inspires me to write sometimes is the void. So I don't necessarily want to write something if someone else has covered it.
Right.
But if I find voids and needs where there needs to be value, that's what gets me going. And so I was like, man, someone's got to do something about this. And there was misconceptions and teams didn't know what the heck. There's just role misconception.
Right.
So I wrote the first edition, but it was very basic. If you, I don't even know if you have a, I don't even know if I have a copy of it. I have an electronic copy.
I do.
But it was sort of basic story writing and basic, you know, I talked about story points from a basic point of view. It was all about the role. I think I talked about Scrum of Scrums a little bit, but scaling was an issue back then, but it wasn't something that I felt like needed to be in the product owner book.
Right.
So to me, it was like an agile Scrum product owner 101 book was the intent. And it was to try to just get people like if you're, and this was happening back then, you'd come into, you know, you were a product manager one day and then your boss would say you're a product owner the next day. So my goal was to, okay, where do you go now? It's like, shoot, what do I do now?
Yeah.
They gave me another job. So go read the book.
Yeah. And so the things that are in there that, and I have had the pleasure of reviewing an early copy of it. So we can, I kind of know what's in there. So you've still hit the basics pretty hard, right? So we still want to make sure people are doing the basics, you know, making sure we still know what's important in there. Talking about the journey of the product owner and what they're trying to accomplish. And then you've got the basics, you know, the role, the backlog, the sprint, the organization. Those parts are still in there from version one through version three.
I reorganized it a bit. So I actually didn't call those out. So the sections, I had a different organization, but for the third edition, I have basically four sections and you alluded to them. I have the role, I have the backlog, I have the sprint, and then I have the organization and the organization is like a dumping ground for other things. And I'll explain what's in there.
Yeah.
The role is roles and responsibilities. The backlog is sort of putting them together. And I added a new chapter in there called the life cycle of a user's story. I always felt like, so in the first two editions, I talked about user stories, like as a, I want so that I talked about acceptance criteria. I gave an example or two. But I really did a crappy job of, so to me, it's not writing a story. Stories have an evolution tied to how they're getting groomed and or how they're getting refined in the backlog, right? They start out as an idea. They start out as an epic. You've heard me use analogies like, you know, sort of we're chipping rocks up. So it's boulders, rocks, pebbles, sand. We have a conveyor belt. They're moving forward.
Right.
And I never had a good example of that. And I felt that was a gap. So it's not a static. I alluded to in the first editions, it was a static thing. And to me, stories aren't statically defined. They're sort of evolutionary, right? We use the term emerge sometimes, which sounds grandiose. But so I wanted to give an example of what does evolution have? So I have the story of a mousetrap that I've written, like Mousetrap the Game and how to develop stories. I hope that does a better job in this edition of describing the life cycle. So that's in the backlog. Then the sprint is the execution dynamics. That makes sense. Meaning chartering. So it starts with charting, but then it's like backlog refinement, then execution, then sprint reviews and think like closing the sprint.
Yeah.
Are the first three sections. So they align pretty much. I touched every chapter. There's not one chapter in the second edition series that I didn't. And I'm not just talking about editing. I move things around.
Yeah.
So the subtopic structure changed. The organization changed. I like this fourth area focus.
Yeah. The mechanics of the sprint and the mechanics of the backlog. And I mean, it's important to hit those things for the new product owner or the beginner. It's not the focus, right? It's there because we need to know how to do that. But that, again, to focus back on the news item today, it's not the point of product ownership. It's one of the things that we do that enables us to get to the end point.
I tried to emphasize things differently this time, sort of like execution. It's not micromanaging the team, but like the role of the product owner in execution, like sort of like the three amigos, emphasizing three amigo interactions and evolving and getting involved in early sort of deployments. And I still, to this day, I still hear this probably 50% of the time in my travels where the product owner looks at their role as engaging at the end of the sprint for some reason, like not even approving stories mid sprint, but waiting to the end for some approval phase or something. And so trying to draw them in. Yeah. So it's the beginning, but also I tried to weave in what I would call more not advanced practices. You and I have talked about like, 1.0 product ownership. This is 2.0. So I don't want to call them advanced, but I do these mature practices, like where to focus your eyes, right?
Yeah.
And in the first two editions, I was focusing too much on the basics. And my intent this time was to change that. And where it's most visible was in the organization. So for example, I wrote a new chapter on arc. So my feeling is, you know, I never approached product ownership, how product owners interact with architects, or how product owners interact with business analysts. Maybe I had a paragraph earlier, or how they interact with UX design and UX. And while those interactions existed in the previous two editions.
Yeah.
I never talked about them. So I have an entire chapter about that. I thought that portfolio level planning, meaning high, like the flow of work from business case epics down to the team. I felt like that, just like the story life cycle was important, I think to get it. I think the portfolio life cycle was important, at least to talk about it, particularly with the scaling models, right? All of the scaling models have that notion.
So there was a couple of changes in there, and it's odd that it wasn't in the second version of the book, but your four quadrants of product ownership, which is something that, you know, I've referenced multiple times on the show, and I reference it all the time in what I'm doing in my role, but that's going to actually be in the book this time.
You know what's weird, and I like that model. You know me. I try not to get stuck on my ideas, and I try to evolve. But that's an idea that I still think is relevant today and helpful. But it missed. I didn't talk about the four quadrants in the second edition. I missed it like by 3 months, unfortunately. Yeah. I talked about the areas, but I didn't really say four quadrants.
Yeah.
And I was hell bent and determined to bring that in. So the entire chapter three in the new book is basics of the role, the four quadrants. So I actually, in fact, in this case, I'm not just introducing the model. I'm really anchoring the role on the quadrants. And it was a timing. I had a brain dead moment, and I missed the opportunity, and I kicked myself like then. And once it's published, you know that once you've published the darn thing, like you're not going to go back.
It's
like
done.
Amazon, it's done.
Yeah.
It's done. So, you know, the other thing while we're talking about stuff that I kick, refinement versus, grooming was another, it may seem like a trivial change to you, but I had grooming everywhere. And you know that we're trying to get away from backlog grooming and go to refinement.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that everyone was correcting me. Oh, Bob, you know, you know, shame on you for using the wrong term again.
Yes. So
that was another thing where I wish I wouldn't have missed the boat, and I would have anticipated that in the second edition as well.
Yeah. So the four quadrants, like I said, it's great to have that anchored there and see that, because I think it's a really good strategy for people to kind of look and say, where am I strong? Where am I weak? What do I need to work on? What am I having problems with?
Yep.
It's really good. There's another focus in there on quality, really focusing in not just on, on the mechanics, but actually focusing on what we're trying to get out of there with good quality product.
That chapter evolved a little bit. So in the first edition, I have this strong, so I have a development background.
Right.
But I have this, I hope it comes through. I have an incredibly strong affinity to quality and testing.
Yeah.
And so in all three editions, there was a quality chapter. Mm. But in the first two, I almost felt like I was preachy. I was like I was coming at it from the point of view of Mr. or Miss or Mrs. P.O., you don't have a clue about quality. Let Bob Galen tell you what quality means. So I had tables that were talking about the different types of testing, if you remember. And yeah. It was a little, and I in review, I was like, oh, you're being an ass. You're being presumptuous. You're like shoving quality down their throat. So in the third edition, I've tried to, the chapter's still there because it's so crucial. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, it's an attribute that the PO needs to be concerned about.
Absolutely.
But not from the perspective of trying to turn them into, like, you have a QA background. I'm not trying to turn them into Corey. I'm not trying to give them
a tester.
Or a tester.
Right.
That's not my intent. And yeah. I think I rebalanced it this time.
Yeah. The whole notion of a quality product, what is that? And how does a product owner know what a quality product is, or make sure that, the focus is on quality, I think is the main.
Well, the other thing, to your point, the support of it, right? The passionate and violent support of quality from a space perspective.
Yeah.
And it's the flip side of it. If you have a product owner who's only focused on getting features out the door, then they can really maliciously affect the team to violate their quality agreement. Yeah. So I wanted to flip it around and say, don't do that.
Yeah.
Right. Be careful. So another way, be careful how you push.
Yes. I've had conversations lately about why unit tests are important. Why? I'm not writing them, and I'm not saying the team has to write them. I'm saying they're important. They're there. They serve a purpose, just like automation tests do and integration tests. And I know what those are because of my background. But I also know as the product owner and product manager, I have to give support for those. I have to say those are important things so that the team, the customers, and everybody else understands that that's what it takes to make a good product. It takes that focus on quality.
And it's not, some of them are not optional. Like there's some things where as a product owner where you have to support the value, right? You have to understand it. But there's a trust factor in, like, let's take unit tests. I think very few product owners, or if any, really have to understand them. It's just, it's not the understanding. It's trusting your team that they believe that unit tests are a construction technique that has great value for software construction that leads to quality. So it's like, damn it. So you have two options. You can get it, you can pair with them and tell them why it's stupid to do it and undermine it. Or you can just say, oh, okay, I trust you. Right.
Yeah.
Just like any technique, your prioritization, your valuation technique, there's a myriad of valuation techniques, right? And so what you select as a PO is sort of your call. And I would hope that the team would trust that you're picking wisely, like how you're determining value. Yeah. And it's the same thing.
Yeah. There's also, and you mentioned it a little bit before, but the focus on stories, and not just stories as a mechanical thing, like the, as a so that I want, but the storytelling aspect of it is the point of the story is not the writing of the story or the posting of the story. It's the talking about the story. It's what's around that's happening. And that should be the focus, not on the card itself.
That's actually an advanced, so sort of a basic, but advanced thing, not even just in the book. I spoke at Agile Maine. So I have this talk that I've been doing whenever I get the chance called Putting the Story Back into the User Story, which is, and it has a little practice session where we write user stories for like a hypothetical epic user story in traditional format. And then we actually do storytelling around it. And it actually resonates pretty well with groups to get that point. So to me, I think we've lost we focus so much on the requirement aspects, the written requirement aspects, and on the tactics that the original intent of the user story was story. Mm-hmm. It was user story.
Yes.
Right. It was big story, mm-hmm. and it was face to face, and it was around, you know, and I know it may sound grandiose, but it really is like storytelling around the campfire and visualization and trying to get the intent I have, the problem, the intent, the passion out to the team so that the entire team understands it. And so narrative.
Yeah.
And we've lost that. And I'm trying in the book, but also in general to get the narrative back.
Yeah.
And to me, if we were looking at maturity, so, you know, shoe level teams write the stories.
Right.
But really the intent of the damn thing is that storytelling. And problem, not just storytelling around the requirement, but like the problem, explain, mm-hmm. or showing even videos. If you could videotape a customer and show a usage scenario or something like that. That's why I like personas so much. I do talk about, I've always talked about personas in the book, but mm-hmm. more as a lip service. And over the three editions, I try to emphasize, I think personas are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
If you get them right, or they augment the story.
Yeah.
So the as a user, so personas help visualize that user.
Yeah.
Right. You're right. So I can visualize it's not the, you know, as a user or as a super user, but as Bob Galen, that moron who's going to be using our software for 2 hours each day.
Yeah.
And he's doing these workflows. How do we delight him?
Yeah. It's something that I've been doing the last couple months is when I talk about stories with teams or customers or anybody else, I just say story. I drop the user part of it because I want, for that specific reason, right? I don't want it to be focused on the user story. I want it to be on the content of that story, the actual storytelling part of it. And that's one of the first suggestions you gave me for the podcast is do something on storytelling. I haven't done it yet because it's an incredibly hard thing to do, right? Is how do we tell better stories? I've given some links and some things, but that's really a good focus for product owners. And we tell stories all the time, not just about a feature or a request, but how something happened or how we got something. I told a really good story today, in a matter of fact, in one of our updates about an idea a user had. You know, she came to me, she talked about a problem she had. I said, great, let's find a way to, you know, make that happen. We put it through our, you know, our evaluation and looked at different angles and looked at the real problem. And we solved that, right? We took a 2-week process down to 5 minutes. That's a really good story to tell. And that makes me, you know, that helps me give leverage for other things I wanted to tell other stories as well.
Exactly. I think there's a granularity thing. So I'm not saying, so in that workshop I talk about, we're really at the epic level. So I think storytelling is more valuable. So not at 2 points. So I don't think we tell stories around the 2-point story.
Right.
If that makes sense. Yeah. But I do think if you're doing themes mm-hmm. or features mm-hmm. or epics, as you have these higher level constructs that take more and more time, that's where the story is from my point of view, or the story of a client, like you're talking about, the client had an idea. That's where storytelling, I think, is incredibly valuable.
Also comes in handy when you're doing your sprint review as well. That's what you should be demoing, even though that's not what we're supposed to be doing, but that's what you should be talking about is the story, not the individual, you know, 5 user stories that ultimately led to that, but talk about the story and what they can do now.
Exactly. The why behind it and the story why behind it. Now there's a, you know, sometimes people look at me, there's a little danger. I keep fighting. I mean, it's not fighting, but I think there's a generational thing that's happening with storytelling where, you know, people look at, you know, Bob Galen, oh, he's almost retired. And he's like one of those old guys who he has 5 stories and he keeps telling the same stories over and over again. So we just bear with him. We let him go. And
who told you we were doing that?
He'll run out of breath. Right. And then he'll shut up on his own. So I think generationally as in the younger generations, mm-hmm. I think there's less and less openness or willingness to listen to longer stories.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the challenges. And I actually think that shouldn't influence the short them. We shouldn't, we shouldn't allow that back pressure to for us to shorten the story. Let's tell the stories and then coach people to sort of be patient and listen to the narrative. As long as we're not having an 1,000-page novel, right? As long as we're sort of tight, listen to the nuance of the narrative. And I guess what I'm saying is some people lack patience. So I think we have to coach more patience rather than cut the stories down, because the stories have value.
Yeah. And that's one of the great things that you've included in the third version is more stories from more product owners and about their experience about, you know, things on writing stories or dealing with stakeholders or anything else.
Well, that was one change. So when Mary and I wrote the three pillars of agile testing and quality, I included Mary, like 50 stories from Mary. We called them Mary's Corners. And I stole this, borrowed this idea from Lisa Crispin and Janet Gregory. If you look at their two QA books, they have a lot of external people contributing. And I just felt that really augmented them. Other voices really helps. So this was the first time. So I had stories in edition one and edition two, but mostly they were mine. So I'm writing, and then I would change the format. I would italicize it. I think you had one. A very small group of people had a story outside of Bob Galen in the two previous editions. But this time, I tried to inject more stories, to your point, and tried to find like those external voices. I didn't get as much of disagreement. I was even looking for people that would say, you know, Bob, you ignorant PO, there's another way to do it. I was trying to look for contrasting voices. I got a little bit of that. I will say this, Corey, this is my last, and I'm saying this with a lot of conviction, this is the last edition.
So in four more years, you're not going to update it to version?
No, okay. No, it will stand the test of time, or it won't, it will. No. So I mean, I was actually, in all sincerity, I was keeping that in the back of my mind too. Part of my, you know, it'll talk to beginners, but also more advanced. I included more stories. I even went through, so I'm cheap, and I self-edited the book, the first two editions, and there's mistakes there, and I get dinged. If you look at my Amazon reviews, I get dinged by a few people on typos and things like that, grammatical stuff. So this time I committed myself to open up my wallet and just get some proper editing. Part of the drive for that was that's really put together. I mean, I was proud of edition one and I'm proud of edition two, but I wanted to put together, this is the quote unquote final one. Let's do a nice job of editing. Let's include some stories if I can find them. Let's make it as relevant as I can for a broader audience, both beginner and advanced, and then sort of put the fork in it.
Okay. And then there's some new things that you've added to this version. I know you mentioned scaling a little bit in version two, but you really kind of went into other scaling models, at least from the product owner's perspective, and a little bit about them in this version, including, of course, Safe, because it's the most popular one, because we have to mention that. And then the other ones, really going into some that I don't think I've heard of before, too. Not outside of Les and Dad, but what's the Scrum one?
Nexus.
Yes.
So I this time I really went into, and it wasn't trying to explain. It's a little bit trying to explain the frameworks, but it's more so trying to put on, I'm a product owner in that framework. Yeah. What are the keys for me to survive and thrive in that framework?
Beyond
Scrum keys.
Yes.
So it's Safe. I always did Scrum of Scrums. So I maintained Scrum of Scrums, although I stripped out, I sort of had this S1, S2, S3, S4. I had a really strong Scrum of Scrums model that I had actually used, and I wanted to share it in the PO book. So I skinnied Scrum of Scrums. Then it was Scrum of Scrums, Safe, Dad, Less, and the Nexus. And I do a little bit of, you know, pro and con from each one of them.
Sure.
They handle things differently. In some cases, like Safe, you know, Safe has, you know, strong portfolio guidance, et cetera. And some other things. I mean, PI planning, for example, it's good, but it does require some additional work on the part of the product owner to get ready for PI planning. And it's not just product owner.
Yeah.
It's, so the other thing in that is product owners having to work together on a train, right? So there's cross product ownership coordination concerns. So that was an expansion in an ad.
And that really helps because, you know, as more and more product owners get put on more and more teams, and they get stretched to the point where, you know, they're probably stretched too thin. And working in enterprises or just with other products, it helps to kind of understand these new things that are coming at you, that are safe and less and other things.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, if you look at, there's a really dangerous direction coming. I didn't really highlight it so much in the book. This is more editorial comment, but I'll pick on Less. Less, for example, has Less, and then there's Less, what is it? Giant Less or something like that. Giant, Less Huge. So, 2 to 9 teams is normal Less. Mm-hmm. And then Less Huge is any organization greater than 9 or 10 teams or something like that. Well, what Less says is there's a single product owner for up to 9 teams.
Yep.
The Nexus does the same thing. So there's this sort of trend that's saying, and I don't know if I agree. I understand it. They want a single, I'm going to use those weird terms, single wrinkleable neck, right? There's a singular voice of the customer that's driving multiple teams so that you don't have lots of dependencies. You have consistency across, you know, there's one backlog that then is stripped down to be fed to multiple teams. So there's one product owner, there's one backlog. And then there's like sub backlogs that come off of that for each team. So have one product owner. That scares me only from, it makes sense. If you've never been a product owner, I actually think you would suggest that for continuity, product continuity and vision. But the day-to-day work of that, like, could you imagine being the PO of literally 9 teams?
No.
And even if the ceremonies were streamlined, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I just don't know how that works in the real world, but that's, they're very firm on it.
Yeah. And they have, I mean, they use different terminology, which is why it's important to look at each of these things. You know, the Safe uses product owner and product manager, is it Less or Dad that uses product owner as kind of the chief product owner or the Uber product owner. And then they use area product owners for subgroups, right?
Exactly. They have some, but there's really, the area product owners are not, they're like helpers.
Yeah.
They're really not the way I think of, you know, of scale. I've always scaled with, there are product owners and then there's a chief product owner.
Yeah.
And there's fully capable product owners per team.
Yeah.
Or maybe one for two teams or something. But I mean, to your point though, there's, the scale, the different models can put some stress on the product ownership role. So I wanted to at least, you know, sort of have a broad brush cover of that. I hope I did a good job.
Yeah, I think it's great. It really helps. There's a couple other things, you know, there. You mentioned architecture before, but you also put in, you know, working with UX, working with DevOps, working with other groups that you need to be able to create those products that are outside the team or that are usually shared between teams.
That's something that I think, I mean, it's an at scale construct, but not framework tied to, right?
Right.
I mean, one of my favorite things is even back to the channel advisor days of the first edition, we had a UX team. And at iContact, we did weird things with UX. At one point, we put them in the scrum teams. At one point, we took them out of the scrum teams. Right. At one point, they reported to me as a development guy. At one point, they reported to product. They almost became like UX product owners, sort of an adjunct to the product side of things, which I felt like was the right place for them. Mm-hmm. But I never ever, in the first two editions, I really, to the best of my recollection, I never spoke about those cross-cutting concerns. Mm-hmm. And I felt like in this edition, while it was relevant historically, I really wanted to do that now. So that was one of the drivers for that, because I think it does matter. I think product ownership does. Yeah. I mean, you have to consider the architectural evolution of things, right?
Yeah. And again, I'll lean back to my favorite.
Didn't I bring up something though that you didn't like? What was there? I think I said, I called him a technical product owner.
Technical product owner is a term that just, I don't like that term because it implies that I'm only focused on the technology side and not on the impact to the user. I've had that title before, which is one of the reasons I don't like it, which is, you focus on the technical aspect. I'm going to focus on the business aspect. It's the same problem I have with product manager / product owner looking at different levels, right? It's I'm strategic or I'm tactical. I'm team-based. I'm program-based. I'm customer-focused. I'm team-focused. Those splits occur some point. I want the focus to be on, can a team solve a user problem, and can the product owner define what value is in that situation and then work with the team to build it?
I hope I described the nuance. Not that I'm trying, it may not make you happy. So I think, depending on people's history, they have different views of it. But what I hope I've nuanced in it. There is a partnership.
Yes.
So right there, like, to me, the technical product owner should be able to represent the functional stuff, and the functional product owner, and I don't like that I'm just using terms, should be. So they should balance the portfolio of work in their backlog.
Yes.
But what I was getting at, Corey, and I'm not, the key thing for me is that, like, a refactoring project. So this comes from my baggage at both iContact and at Channel Advisor. With larger scale firms, we characterized architectural work in story format and injected it in backlogs because we wanted that work to be aggregated and compared against other work, right? We didn't want to overload the team. We didn't want to hit teams with two streams. We didn't want an architectural team that's working in a vacuum apart. Like, all architectural refactoring work was just dovetailing into the team backlog.
Right.
Now, some teams did more of it than other teams. Some teams didn't do it at all. Like, it would be targeting towards the teams. But what we found is it was too much to ask a functional, what I would call a functional product owner. This stuff was too deep technically, right? We were like refining, we were re-architecting like performance improvements and things like that.
Yeah.
So it really helped to have someone who could guide that technically, but they still had to integrate one with the other in a partnership. So hopefully
it's
job.
Fine. Again, it's a title, right? It's, what do you call that person? What do they do? I've had really big refactoring projects or really big things that I needed to do technically that I didn't know as the product owner, how to accept that work or how to define that work. I worked with people who did. I worked with architects, dev managers, development people who really understood that, and they became the captain of that epic or story or whatever, and helped shepherd that through. Yeah.
So that's really what I've seen, right? Yeah. Is that the other thing that drove me is the two blog posts, and I have no idea how many blog posts I have on my blog. I should count them sometime, or the word count would probably, I'd die probably if I counted words. But the two most popular blog posts on my blog are one that talks about technical product ownership and then writing technical user stories.
Yeah.
And technical user stories are like, what does the story look like if it's trying to capture a refactoring? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And by far, those over the years, they every year over year, I mean, these are old. I wrote them years ago, Corey, like three, 4 years ago. They're still year over year, they're the highest hitting stories in my, so I felt compelled to try to hit that a little bit the pain factor.
That's great. Okay. You working with UX, you're working with DevOps, architecture, really finding ways to deal with those are great adds to the book. So you mentioned that the book is going to be out in early 2018. And that's why I wanted to talk to you, before we finish our season 3, just so people can, know it's coming, get excited about it, look out for it. I'm sure you'll put links and tweets out, and we definitely will share it as well, because you've been generous with the version 2, being able to send that out to folks.
So I have downtime. I'm having a surgery, and I'm going to have downtime in December and January and even in February. So with as much downtime, and I'm not going to be able to travel. The bad news there is the downtime, but the good news there is I'll have time to commit to the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I will, I'm guaranteeing it right now. I'm putting a line in the, putting a line in the sand.
You do realize I am recording this, right?
I know. The book will be out by the end of February, 2018.
Well, there you go.
Is that a leap year? Do I get an extra day?
I don't
know. Probably not. Probably not.
Would it help?
No, no. If I'm quibbling about a day, then I have bigger problems than that.
So that'll be great. I can't wait for that. I'm sure that it'll go in right with my version 2 and version 1 as well.
I've gotten a lot of good feedback. I mean, you don't, when you write books the way I have, they're self-published and, you know, I get reviews on Amazon and things, but I get these little snippets. One of the reasons I wanted to do the third edition as well is I've gotten, it achieved the results. The why behind me writing it in the first place is I was trying to help. Mm-hmm. I get enough sales. It's my number one selling book. I get enough snippets and enough little personal, I get work from it as well.
Yeah.
But I get enough sort of, you know, interest that I'm like, it's making a difference.
Yeah.
And it continues to do that, which sort of blesses me. I sometimes get, not sometimes, I'm usually surprised that it's actually making a difference out there. So.
I definitely agree with that. It is, like I said, it's one of the things that I started with that just really, you know, helped me understand a lot, about the role and about what it does. So thank you. If I've never said it before, let me say it now. Thank you for writing the book, Bob.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a labor. It's an incredible amount of. So that's one of the reasons now I can whine a little bit. Why am I slowing down? Why am I off schedule?
Here it comes.
Right. But it's more work. You forget the work when you're writing it.
Yeah.
And then it's iterative work.
Yes.
And it's sort of, and the editing cycle goes on and on and on. And then it's like, oh my God. Shoot me. I've read this chapter like 22 times.
Yeah.
So you can easily lose momentum and stuff.
So
and thankfully I forget that. Otherwise I might not start.
Yeah. But so when the book comes out, our listeners are now obligated to buy it and read it so that Bob will know that his effort has not been in vain.
Well, I promise you, not only is it going to be out on the 28th, but I think I've given you free copies in the past. I'll give you some
you
free
have.
Copies as giveaways. So you'll get some third edition stuff as giveaways. And so we'll, you know, I have to promote it. So that would be cool.
Absolutely.
So I promise you that as well. Absolutely. And you're a contributor. So ladies and gentlemen, excuse me, hold on a second. hold on. Stop the presses. Corey Bryant is a key reviewer and a key contributor to the book. So he has some real estate in the book and valuable real estate. I valued his opinion. So it's not a one man show. This is it was a labor of love for the two of
and
us.
It's,
or more of us.
It's one of the things that I'm very happy to have contributed to it. It's one of the things I'll hold it up and go, yes, this is the thing you should read. And yes, this is the thing you should, you know, try to accomplish. And yes, oh, by the way, I wrote a story about it or something in it. So yeah, I'm very happy to be able to contribute to it. So if you have any feedback or any questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at DeliberateCast, or you can email us at DeliberateCast@gmail.com. And when you do, we will send you a copy of Rob's book, the second edition right now, third edition coming up. Please share the show around. We've had some great success this season with people sharing and finding us for the first time and going back and listening to all the episodes, crazy people. But thank you for doing that. Do share it. Tell them why you love it. And while you're at it, you can leave us a rating and a review. We did get a question this week from Andrew, who says, I recently become a product owner for a product area with two systems that are running in production. I have deep fears that the system is technically bankrupt, but I'm having a hard time as the product owner figuring out how to quantify that and explain it with my engineers, engineering managers, and stakeholders. He says, there are other people on my team who fear this is true or are convinced that it's true, but getting the whole team to see this is going to be hard, especially because we have a team members who built it and they've invested years in it. This is much a people problem as a technical problem. Side note, agree. But the justification should be fact-based, and having far less context on the systems and engineers is hard to make that argument without hitting counter arguments. I can't refute myself. Help. So the first thing that I want to comment on is there are no technical problems. There are all people problems. That's something that I've had beaten into my head, and I completely agree with, is all these things are people problems. The thing that I would suggest, because it's something that I've had to do a couple times, is yes, you think there are problems. Yes, you can you have that feeling, that gut feeling that maybe nobody else is buying into. The first thing you have to do, you mentioned it, is fact-based, is gather data. Find some data either on the number of bugs you have, the number of failures you have, the number of problem calls or issues with that. Start gathering data to show that there is instability in the system or there are issues that need to be looked at. I've been producing metrics, and one of the things that we've been able to show is that 60% of the time that we're working on, you know, a sprint, a PI or whatever, we're focused on, you know, things that keep the lights on for our product. It's an old product. It's very similar to what you're talking about, Andrew. It's a legacy system. It's got a lot of issues that we're trying to refactor out and build new things. But we have the data that says we're spending the majority of our time, 60% of our time, on making sure the system doesn't fall over or doing things to make it keep running. That's not where we want to spend our time, but that's what we have to do. And by collecting the data, I've been able to do that. So it's starting to sink through. It's not going to be a, you know, an overnight, here's the data, and they go, oh, well, we have to change everything. It's going to take repetitive exposure to those metrics and repetitive exposure to the problems that are that cause when you have a technically bankrupt system, to be able to see that it is an issue, or it has to fail over, and then it gets, you know, run up to the executives, and then it'll be a problem. So my first and best suggestion that I have is really just start collecting data on it. Bob, what do you think?
I run the danger of disagreeing with you a little bit.
Please, go ahead.
It's not anti-data, but I would actually start, I might start by giving the team space for refactoring. So, and not be data-based. Mm-hmm. So instead of, so if you have no data, it might take time to get the data, and you have a people problem where there's originators and then maybe additional software engineers. Mm-hmm. So as a product owner, I might just say, look, I want to allocate 20% of the backlog. I'm going to fight for 20% of the backlog to give you all space, you know, literally you all space, mm-hmm, to improve the app. It's not personal, right? Apps degrade over time. And that's a fact of life. And refactoring is a way to refresh it. So it's not personal. I'm not looking for a scapegoat. If we have some bugs, I might use that not to tell the team, but to sort of, you know, show the team that we do have some fragility. Mm-hmm. But then what I'd be looking for, I'm giving the team space to figure out space to consider where do we attack. I'd be looking for the team to come up with strategy. For ownership, I'd be looking to develop some shared ownership over improving the app. Mm-hmm. Now once we had a strategy, once we had some space, once it was like the whole team, right? And we took the personalities out of play, and we just focused on improvement for the customer, then I would go to where Corey's talking about, then gather some data to sort of support your refactoring strategy or your improvement plan. But the other thing is, I wouldn't get too, yes, leaders always want the data, mm-hmm, but there's this counterpoint where the teams know where the shit is as well.
Yes.
And what if we can't get data, but we still know it smells bad? Mm-hmm. You know, it tastes bad. It smells bad. It is bad, but we don't know how to represent it. There's something called trust the team. So there's this balancing act. I'm probably not saying it well, Corey, but there's data, yes, but there's also giving the team the space even longer term to like trust their judgment, and maybe they can produce data after a refactoring.
It is something. So I agree with the idea of let's build some space in to fix these things, right? We know it's something that we're doing with our teams now, and something I've done, encouraged a lot of is, you know, that 10-20% of technical items. One of the things with our schedule right now, we figured out a way to bake in a technical week, because of the way our PIs are laid out, is I want 4 weeks a year at a minimum to focus on technical things, right? What do we need to improve to make the system better, the application better for you, the team that's charged with fixing and supporting it, the users, you know, to make sure that our customers and our clients don't experience, you know, downtimes or errors or things that we can prevent or things that they're seeing now that are, you know, repetitive. How can we get rid of those things? Things that make it easier to deploy the system or things like that. You know, those are things that I definitely want us to work on and continue to work on until it's not an issue anymore, right? Especially in legacy systems, it is an issue and you have to plan for it.
Exactly. I mean, put the monkey on the back of the team more than on the back of the product owner. Yeah. I mean, really make it the team's not, but in a positive way. It's like, guys and gals, I'm giving you the time. We, the business is giving you, I'm fighting for it, the time and the space. Let's leverage it effectively to knock out some of the, you know, some of the foibles we have in the app.
Yeah. And you as the product owner can help guide that message, right? It's not just feature, 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 feature. It's product, product, product. Product includes the things you have to do to make it run.
Exactly. Well. So it was really a dovetail to you. And you know what it was based on? Like so often, you know this, you've seen this. Mm-hmm. The developers, everyone's whining about it, but they don't know. No one's ever given them the time to actually dissect it. So part of, you can say data, it's actually a management trick. I ask for data, knowing that the team's not going to be able to provide data, so I can still shove features down their throats for a while. Yeah. And even if they come with data, I'm like, oh, it's rudimentary data. It's not good enough. It's feature, feature, feature. So give the team space to actually put a thoughtful, like do some analysis, and then we can apply the data to that. Right?
And the only other argument I would make is once you have that data, don't just show the data. Tell the story that the data provides.
Oh, my Lord. That was smooth.
Huh?
That was as smooth as a single malt scotch. Ooh.
That's what you're aiming for, right? It's not necessarily we have 300 defects. It's what is behind those 300 defects or what's behind those things. And then let that kind of be what, you know, you talk about with your stakeholders and clients and teams. It's the story.
You know what, Corey, this happens so rarely in life. I'm just silent. I don't.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. That was perfect.
Let's enjoy that.
Well,
let's enjoy a moment of Bob being speechless. All right. Cool. Thank you, Andrew, for that question. And thank you, Bob, for joining me on the podcast yet again. A pleasure, as always.
You rock. Watching people around me evolve and learn and do their own thing is just the coolest thing for me. And Corey, you've been one of the great ones that have just, you've changed, you've evolved, you've learned, you've been open-minded. You're doing this podcast for people, you're giving back. So thank you for inviting me. It was my pleasure. I'll do it 100 more times if you want. It's something that I really enjoy, and I enjoy interacting with you. So thank you for all you do, sir.
Thank you. And if you want to catch up with Bob, you can follow him on Twitter at Bob Galen, and also all his blogs that he writes and all his other information that he's doing, including his Cal class, which I took in June and was fantastic, is a really good thing for product owners, leaders, I think, to go to really find out, you know, how to get better, continue to improve. So check that out at rgalen.com. Anything else, Bob, you want to shout out about?
Nope, that's it. Thank you so much, sir.
Oh, and the Metacast. Go listen to the Metacast, one of our other Agile Podcast Network shows, him and Josh Anderson. Very good. All opinions expressed here are mine, and you can find more at It's Corey Bryant on Twitter. That is episode 64, delivered. Go out and own your outcome. This show is part of the Agile Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.